Good morning. Can you hear me okay in the back? Yeah? All right, great. This reminds me of one of my classrooms where nobody wants to sit up front. I'm really happy to be here today, happy to be here with you all. You should know that I'm spending most of my month over on the Hill dealing with various congressmen and committees. So I'm very happy to be here in this room this morning to talk about the importance of technology for NASA's future. This talk is going to be perhaps a little bit different than a little higher level, I guess I'd say, than some of the other talks that I'm sure that are going on in this forum. I wanted to give you kind of a high level, the strategy, if you will, the high level strategy that's going on in our planning process for the future from a technology perspective. And let me just start right at the top with a high-level description of the president's 2011 budget request. I'm sure that many of you in this room are aware of the details of that budget. I view the budget, the FY11 budget request, very favorably. I can tell you straight up that I wouldn't have come back to NASA without a budget request like this. Right? I didn't know the details of the budget request when I came back. I started on February 1st, by the way, the day the budget was rolled out. But, you know, for somebody like me who's been involved in research and technology and in advancing that research and technology into our flight missions and actually proving out those technologies in flight, this is the kind of budget that I can get excited about. And as I travel around to the centers, as I travel to industry, as I travel to academia, what I'm finding is amazing. I'm finding people all over the country that are jumping to get into this program, that are excited about this program. And what they're excited about are a few things. First of all, it's important to realize that the NASA budget increased. You know, we seldom hear this, right? You read the newspapers, you wouldn't know that the NASA budget increased. But the president's FY11 budget request has a $6 billion increase for NASA over a five-year period, has $300 million increase in FY11 proposed. This is all not approved, okay? I'm just talking about the proposed budget. That's a big deal, right? When was the last time NASA had a budget increase that wasn't just inflationary? Right? Think about it. Okay? This increase, of course, there's a large allotment of this increase for science, and most of that is in earth science. Okay, probably for many of you in the room here, that's really what you want to hear me talk about. I'm not going to talk too much about that other than to say that I support it, and I'm interested in that, and I was happy to see that. There's also an increase in aeronautics, which I also strongly support. Aeronautics has been on the decline for a little while now, and a 15% increase, which is only about $75 million per year, is pretty important for our aeronautics enterprise, for the first A in NASA. What you hear about in the newspaper all the time is human exploration, right? If you live here in Washington or in the surrounding area, that's what the debate is all about. I'm not going to say too much about human exploration. I can tell you that because of the debate, I spend an awful lot of my time working the human exploration issues and the strategy of our human exploration program. I do want to make a couple points, though. First of all, the goal of our human exploration program at NASA has not changed. Despite what you may read in the newspapers, the goal of our human exploration program was, is today, and always will be, to extend human presence beyond low Earth orbit. That's what this program, the human exploration program, is all about. What has changed, or what has shifted, is our approach to meeting that goal. And in the president's proposed budget for NASA, our approach includes a much stronger focus on the International Space Station to extend its life through at least 2020 and fully utilize the International Space Station as the test bed, as the laboratory that it can be, both for science and for technology, I should point out. And perhaps the center of the argument, at least in Washington, is this commercial approach that is part of the president's budget request to low Earth orbit access, right? Turning the delivery of supplies and eventually people up and down to low Earth orbit over the commercial sector so NASA can focus on extending human presence beyond low Earth orbit. Okay? What I am going to talk about is this bullet down here at the bottom. Because when you read the president's budget request, and by the way, I'm talking not just for NASA, but across all of the federal government, what you'll find is that there's a significant focus on technology development. Within NASA, there's a significant focus on technology development, both in our new approach to human exploration and in a new program that I'm going to talk about today, the Space Technology Program, which is a new budget line item in the president's FY11 request. So I'll focus largely on this, why I think this is a good idea, and what we've been doing really to plan our space technology program. Last point I want to make is really just as important as all the others. This budget and this administration is very serious about partnerships, about leveraging resources of other government agencies, about full engagement with our international partners, about rebuilding a partnership with academia that has frankly, you know, been down a little bit. And in fact, I don't know this for a fact, but I think a large reason of why I was selected as the chief technologist was because, you know, frankly, I was coming out of academia to do that. And it's a, I view it as a symbol, frankly, of the administration's willingness to work with academia in the future. So I know that we've talked, and I know that NASA has been interested in partnerships and has been interested in education, particularly STEM education, for a while now. What I'm really trying to tell you is that the attention that those activities have get is going to be ramping up significantly. The attention to partnerships and the attention to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education is only going to go up. Now, a lot of people have asked me, well, where did this come from? You know, why are we doing what I'm referring to as a technology-enabled approach to science and exploration? Why are we doing that? You know, is that something that NASA just kind of made up and they thought, well, you know, let's try this for a little while? You know, absolutely not. This strategy didn't actually come from NASA. It didn't come from, as has been reported in the press, from OSTP or other folks in Washington. It came from report after report after report over the last 10 years. And I just have a few of them up here from 2008 and 2009. These are some of the recent reports. Dealing with the way that NASA had, these are all reports that draw conclusions based on NASA's previous approach to technology development, okay, or to research. What I have up here are four NRC reports. They're ordered by time, so it's the second to the fourth, if you can't read it in the back, and this one on the bottom are NRC reports. Right here we have Augustine Committee report, and at the top we have the most recent NASA Authorization Act, the one of 2008. Okay, and without going into the specifics of the words on this slide, let me just tell you that all of these reports say the same thing in regard to technology development. Okay. First of all, they all say that it's important, right? If NASA is going to be at the cutting edge, I mean, you guys all know this. If NASA is going to be at the cutting edge, if our missions are going to be grand missions as opposed to, say, incremental kind of missions, we need to invest in our future. It's kind of a logical, rational approach. And over the past decade or so, our investments in the future, our investments in research and technology within NASA, have been decreased. So this is not just a, by the way, this is not just a in the past administration versus, you know, this administration. You can look historically and you can see that over more than a decade, whether we're talking about Democratic administrations or Republican administrations, the investment that NASA had been making in research and technology had been on the decline as the agency became more and more mission focused. Now, in the last administration, it became very mission focused, and that's clear to everybody. But this trend was going on for quite some time. And these reports cite that, okay? And then they give recommendations for what NASA should do. And basically they say that NASA should rebuild It's research and technology competency. Now, I state it that way because if you go all the way back to the Space Act, 1958, the establishment of NASA, and you look at what NASA's been doing since that time, in my view, there are three fundamental core competencies that make NASA what it is, make NASA a unique place within the federal government. The first of those is research and technology, right? For NASA to be cutting edge, we have to invest in our future. We have to invest in research and technology. The second, I would call flight hardware development or flight systems development. I could include software in there as well. Flight systems development. Okay. And the third would be mission operations. Right. Now, all three of those core competencies are fundamental to the health of NASA. Right? I think of them as three legs of a stool. Right? And imagine what that stool would do if one of them were removed. Let's say we remove the research and technology core competency, which is what's been going on for the past decade. Think about what those missions would look like. Think about how risk-averse NASA would become and how incremental our progress would be towards our science, exploration, and aeronautics goals. Okay? Alternatively, think about if all we did was research and technology, and we didn't have any funding, any significant emphasis on flight missions, flight systems or mission operations, NASA would be the NSF, essentially, right? And the NSF already exists. We don't need NASA to be the NSF, right? So to me, what makes NASA unique is those three fundamental core competencies all being healthy and all being integrated together, okay? And the reason that I came back to NASA and what I'm excited about is the opportunity to rebuild that R&T competency, research and technology, not, by the way, to the adverse effect of the other two competencies, but to bring it up enough so that it's at least visible, so that people know that NASA is doing work in research and technology, and so that NASA together is healthy again. Now, just as one example, and this I will admit to you up front, this is perhaps this is about the grandest example that I can come up with. But as one example for the reason to do technology investment, let's talk about sending humans to Mars one day, to the surface of Mars. Right? Now, admittedly, this is something, if this occurs in my lifetime, this will be the grandest exploration adventure that NASA could undertake. I actually can't think of something larger that NASA could undertake from a technology perspective that's going to occur in my lifetime. Now, the president, in his April 15th speech, laid out a set of goals, of dates and destinations for our human spaceflight program. He said that in the early part of the next decade, we're going to fly our next generation human spacecraft on test flights in the Earth-Moon system. In 2025, we're going to send humans on the first ever deep space exploration mission to a near-Earth object. And in 2035, we're going to send humans out to Mars where they will orbit Mars and return safely. And he did say that, at some later date, he didn't specify a date, but at some later date, they would land on the surface. He did mention that he hoped it was in his lifetime, which is kind of important for me because I think we're about the same age. He might be in better health than I am, I'm not sure. So let's talk about human Mars exploration. This slide here shows the mass required to accomplish one round trip human Mars mission to send four astronauts to the surface of Mars and return them safely in a given launch opportunity. And it's plotted, this mass is plotted on the y-axis. And the reason this slide is so interesting to me is it's plotted in units of International Space Station mass. So one here, right here, this little icon, that's where we are today with the International Space Station after essentially 10 years of building that laboratory. We're at one on this scale. Now, this is the mass required, by the way, not on the ground. This is the mass required in low Earth orbit to accomplish the mission. So you can see with our current technologies, we would need something like 10 or 12 International Space Stations of mass in low Earth orbit to accomplish that mission. Does it sound feasible to you? I don't know. Sounds like I'm going to have a hard time taking that to Congress. okay, to me. But with the development of a variety of technologies, and by the way, most of these have to do with propulsion for this particular mission, because of that mass, something like 80% of it is propellant in this column right here. Okay. So if we have a better in-space propulsion system, if we have reduced cryogenic boil-off content, if we use aerocapture to reduce our propellant needs, if we use in-situ resources at Mars to reduce our propellant needs, you know, the mass comes down. And it comes down pretty significantly. In fact, it comes down to something like 2 International Space Stations. Now, I'll admit to you that if it takes 2 International Space Stations of mass to accomplish this mission, it's still pretty darn hard, right? It's NASA hard, right, as opposed to DARPA hard. This is a NASA hard mission. It's not something we're going to obviously do. But I'll tell you what, if it's 2 International Space Stations, I can at least construct an argument that it's possible. It's at least in shooting distance, okay? Whereas up at 10 or 12, I might as well not be talking about sending humans to the surface of Mars. And this is the benefit of technology investment. This is an example for our human spaceflight program, but there are plenty of examples in the Science Mission Directorate and in aeronautics as well. Now, some folks have argued that we don't know, you know, this technology development program is new. We don't know what technologies to invest in. You know, we're just spinning our wheels. Let me tell you, that is absolutely not true. And once again, because all the debate is in human exploration in this town, I've kind of focused in these next couple slides on human exploration. But what I have here are a set of reports. In fact, you can come to my office and you can see the reports. They stack up from the floor almost to my height. And these are reports that have been done by external groups, by Blue Ribbon commissions, by internal NASA teams, all reports on the same subject, basically. All reports that say, you know, these are the technologies that NASA should invest in for its future human exploration program, for its future science programs, and for its future aeronautics programs. So I have a couple of those reports listed here, starting all the way back in 1969 with the post-Apollo Space Task Group. This is what they were, you know, after the Apollo program when it was winding down and then NASA was trying to decide, what are we going to do with our human spaceflight program? There was a pretty significant group put together by the president to take a look at that. Pioneering the Space Frontier in 1986 was another look at technology requirements for human exploration. The Sally Ride Report the next year, the 90-day study under the first President Bush, Augustine's first report in 1990, going to Augustine's most recent report in 2009. And what I've done is I've gone through those reports on this slide, dealing with the technology requirements just for human exploration. And it's fascinating to me. If you read through these reports, they all call out, these technologies that are listed in the rows of this table. And what you can see is there's a pretty strong correlation. It's not 100%. Right, every report doesn't say we need exactly the same technology suite. But it's not that we don't know what capabilities we need to send humans beyond low Earth orbit. It's not that we don't know what, say, transportation advances we need to enable our future science missions, or even sensor advances that we need to enable our future science missions. These things have been studied time and time again. And what we've done at NASA since I've been there in February is we've been taking all this input and we've been formulating our technology programs. And when I'm talking about the technology programs, I'm talking about those programs. Oh, that's embarrassing. Sorry. Oh, it's my wife. I'm sorry. Don't tell her. Don't tell her. Sorry. I'll call her right back. I'm probably in trouble. All right, so our technology programs. So when I talk about our technology programs, I want to point out one thing. I'm talking about the space technology program, the technology program that I am, through the Office of the Chief Technologist, that I am directly managing. But I'm also talking about the technology programs in each of the mission directorates. And because I was talking about human exploration previously, I have ESMD listed on this slide, okay? But it could just as easily say SMD, okay? Just ignore the E if you like, all right? And what I want you to realize is what we have done is we have formulated technology programs that go from TRL of 1, from concepts and system studies, all the way through flight demonstration, TRL of 6, all the way into operational missions, TRL of 9. What we have done in the formulation of our plans for the President's proposed FY11 budget is we've developed a complete suite, an integrated suite, that's not me, an integrated suite of technology programs that span the range of TRLs required to take a concept from an idea all the way into flight. And there are two kinds of programs. There's the space technology program, which I define as a technology push program, and I'll explain that a little bit more in just a minute. And then within each of the mission directorates, within SMD, ARMD, ESMD, and SOMD, there are what I call technology pull programs. Okay. For low TRL work, it's almost all in the space technology program. All the TRL 1-2 kind of stuff is in this new program that I'm going to describe for you. Okay? For TRL 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 6, it's actually in all these areas. It's in the space technology program, and it's in the mission directorate technology programs. And it needs to be in both places. And then as you go beyond TRL of 6, you're talking about missions, and that's obviously in the mission directorates. Okay? The Office of the Chief Technologist is not a mission directorate. We don't own any missions. Okay, we're not a mission-focused organization. The Office of the Chief Technologist is a technology push organization. Now, what I'm talking about here about technology pull and technology push, what I'm really referring to is the following. If a mission directorate has a high-level set of goals, right? SMD has the decadal surveys. ESMD has the speech that the president gave with dates and destinations about high-level goals for human exploration. You know, the mission directorates are very good at taking those high-level goals and turning them into mission architectures, flowing those mission architectures down into missions, then into spacecraft, and then into technologies. It's a nice requirements flow-down kind of approach. And they can then make investments in technologies, to build spacecraft, to have missions, to meet those high-level goals, right? Now, the space technology program is fundamentally different because we're not a mission-focused organization, right? We don't have those missions. But what we do have, and I'll show you in a minute, is we have grand challenges that we want to enable. We want to enable the agency to be able to do. And so while the mission directorates have specific technology investments that they think are required to make their missions work, to meet their strategic goals, what we're going to be investing in the space technology program are cross-cutting capabilities, things that span multiple mission directorates, and I'll give you some examples in a minute, or disruptive technologies, technologies that are high risk, but should they pay off, would change the way a mission directorate does business. Okay? So my cell phone rang a minute ago, right? How many people in this room have a cell phone? Yeah, I'd be surprised if you don't, right? How many of you had a cell phone 10 years ago? Oh, you're lying. I didn't have one 10 years ago, right? So my kids think that the internet always existed. They have no recollection of a time when there was no internet, right? The internet and cell phones are just, you know, a couple of examples, right? But what they're disruptive approaches. They are game changers, right? And I don't use that word very often, by the way. But they change the way we do business, right? I can't put my cell phone down now. I'm in trouble because I didn't answer it when my wife called, right? You know, when I'm in meetings, supposedly paying attention to the meeting, I'm constantly texting other people about my next meeting, right? And I'm sure that many of you do the same. They have fundamentally changed the way we do business. The technology investments we're going to make in the space technology program are in that vein. They are high-risk investments. They won't all pan out. Many of them will fail. Okay, but those that do pan out will change the way NASA does its business. So what I've been doing since February is building this new program and establishing the Office of the Chief Technologist. And this is an org chart without names in it for what this office is going to look like. We'll talk maybe later about the functions at the top of the office, but the space technology program is basically going to be run in these three divisions: early stage innovation, game-changing technology, and cross-cutting capability demonstration. And it's going to consist of 10 programs, and those are listed in the boxes beneath. There are five here, two, and three. Level two program assignments at various centers have already been announced, and those are shown on this slide as well. I'm going to go through some of these programs in more detail, and I'm going to focus on the ones that I think that you might be most interested in. You're welcome to ask me any questions you like about any of the programs within OCT or outside of OCT a little bit later. We've staffed up this office, by the way. We've integrated in the IPP folks, Innovative Partnership Program. There are about 14 people in IPP that have moved into my office. And we're staffing up to eventually have about 40 or 50 people run this office out of Washington. Let me give you a couple of tenets about the way we're going to run the Space Technology Program. So I've mentioned that it's not a mission-focused program. I don't have a great word for that. Right? I say it's non-mission focused. It's not very, I don't think you can look that up in the dictionary. But another way to state that would be that we're going to invest in broadly applicable technologies, or we're going to produce technological products for which there are multiple customers. We're not talking about a sensor for the next Earth science mission, but perhaps we're talking about a strategic investment that would enable a whole suite of Earth science missions in the future. Or a technological investment that would enable a suite of Earth science missions and perhaps some other government agency or exploration missions with that single investment. Okay. We're going to run this program largely in a competitive manner, and we're going to employ a portfolio approach that spans the entire technology readiness level. Now, this competitive process will enable teams of folks in academia, in industry, at the NASA centers, at the other government labs, to all participate in this program. We are going to leverage the investments of our international and other government agency and other partners in the execution of this program. Now, how are we going to do this? All right, you know that if I put out a solicitation and I say, technology, that's what we want, right? Send us your ideas. It would be overwhelming. It would be overwhelming for the community, and it would be overwhelming for me to have to read all of those proposals. Okay. So what we've done instead, you know, we don't have a set of missions, but what we do have is the NASA strategic plan. And you can take the NASA strategic plan, and you can flow it down into a set of grand challenges. Now, I want you to notice the big five-letter word, draft, on this slide, because we're still working on this. Okay. But these are the kinds of grand challenges that one can come up with from the NASA strategic plan. And we've just to simplify it, I've organized it in three columns. One, making space part of our routine environment, you know, access to space and communications from space, data from space, that sort of thing. Managing space as a natural resource and quests for the future. And notice this question mark here, because one of the things we're going to do is solicit ideas from the community for grand challenges in the future. We're going to run a grand challenge-like program, and that's where the DARPA-like term comes from. Right? DARPA, the way it operates, ARPA-E, the way they operate, they specify grand challenges. They use those grand challenges to put out solicitations for particular capabilities, and they don't specify the technological solution that they're seeking. That's what we're not going to specify. There's not going to be a call that specifies a particular technological solution. We're going to use these grand challenges to organize our calls, and we're going to put out solicitations for capabilities that fit within these grand challenges. The community will then respond through a competitive process with various technological solutions, and we will select several of them for funding for a while. You could think of it as a phase one, if you like, for a phase one type funding, and then we'll do a down selection at a later time when we have enough information to do that down selection in an informed manner. And we'll take that down selected technological solution all the way to flight, should it prove feasible to do so. So another way of stating that is shown here. We start with, instead of missions, we start with what I call strategic opportunities that flow from NASA's strategic plan. From those opportunities, we can develop challenge goals. And I gave you a draft set on the previous slide. For those challenge goals, we can envision enabling capabilities. And then from those capabilities, you can, you know, technological solutions will, you know, fit in and will be put together to develop these capabilities to enable these challenge goals and to meet our strategic opportunities. And it's in this manner, and this is just some of the kinds of things, you know, based on the RFIs that are already on the street and some of the responses that we've been getting. This is just a list. It's not an inclusive list. It's an example list of the kinds of activities that we might fund through this program. And I have some additional examples coming up. So another way to view this program is, you know, through some kind of funnel picture. Some kind of funnel graphic. You can think of it as hundreds or thousands of ideas, you know, visions of the future. That's the early stage innovation piece of the program, where we're going to solicit ideas from everyone. We're going to look for the best ideas wherever they may come from in the early stage innovation division. I should point out that in my time at Langley, I've done a lot of this systems analysis. I've looked at a lot of the visions of the future. And I'll tell you, after you've worked on one of these system studies for a year or so and you put it in, there's nothing more beautiful than that system study in that nice 15-page report where everything looks perfect. But whoever submits that idea, they know, at least I always did, and I assume most people do, there's always this little piece of physics that's kind of holding that concept back, right? If only we could make this physics breakthrough, well, the rest of the system concept, the rest of the vision of the future, that'd be no problem. It'd be a no-brainer. It would happen. And so we're going to go after that fundamental physics in ground-based testing and laboratory testing in the game-changing technology program. Through this program, we're going to solicit both small and large projects in a DARPA-like manner. They will be run for, say, a 2 to 3 year period of time where we focus on and go after the fundamental feasibility of some of these early stage ideas, based on that physics. And when we prove something is successful, is possible, we're going to take it over here to the cross-cutting capability demonstration division and prove it in a flight-like environment. We're going to prove it in low Earth orbit flight tests, you know, in atmospheric flights, it depends on the technology, you know, exactly where we're going to prove it. Now, when we go over here to cross-cutting, when we're talking about, is that technology flight ready, we're going to do that in partnership with our customers. A customer being a mission directorate like SMD, a customer being another government agency. A customer is actually, or it could be a commercial world, right? A customer is actually anybody who's willing to put some skin in the game. And we're going to require that our customers pony up a minimum of 25% of the cost of that flight demonstration, right? And that's how we're going to work this infusion problem. We're actually going to work infusion all the way back here, but at a lower level. We're going to involve the mission directorates and the other government agencies in these selections, but we're not going to actually ask for money until we get over to cross-cutting. And I'll give you a little more detail on some of these in just a minute. So early stage innovation. This is our visions of the future, right? This division sponsors a wide range of low TRL efforts in advanced space system concepts and technology development. It does so broadly. 100% of this division is competed. Everything in this division will be competed. There are several new programs And down here, there are two programs that are carried in from IPP, from the Innovative Partnership Program. SBIR and STTR, I'm sure you're all familiar with. Centennial Challenges has been a very successful program over the last few years that's been run out of IPP. The three new programs I want to mention very quickly, Space Technology Research Grants. It's comprised, there's two pieces of this program. There's a Space Technology Grant piece, and that is essentially going to be, my best way to explain it quickly is, it's fundamental aeronautics for space. It's fundamental aeronautics for space folks. Okay, within ARMD, they have a program called Fundamental Aeronautics. It's a fairly successful program, and this is a space equivalent to that. The other piece of the Space Technology Research Grants program is a large graduate fellowship program. We're going to try to engage engineers and scientists of the future through a high-profile fellowship program, more significant than the GSRP, to be honest. Be equivalent in stature to NSF fellows. I know as a university professor, I know the excitement that students get when they win an NSF fellowship. I can tell you that on campuses all around the country, if you get a graduate student with an NSF fellowship, it's a big deal. Right? What I want is for it to be a big deal when they win a space technology fellowship. And so we've set up this fellowship to be very much like the NSF. It's the same in dollar value. There's some additional funds for the university advisor. And the thing that makes this nice is there's also going to be some funds for a NASA advisor to work with these students. And so these students will have the benefit of both, they'll do most of their research on the university campus, but when it's convenient for them in the summers or other semesters when it's convenient, they'll be able to spend some time, there's a stipend for travel, they'll be able to spend some time at one of the NASA centers or one of the national labs, working directly with a professional advisor who's interested in their research and who's been aligned based on research interests. This will be a great way for us to build the pipeline of young engineers and scientists into our program. The NIAC is going to come back. NIAC is the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts. Many of you may remember the NIAC. It existed previously. It was one of the programs that was terminated just a few years ago as the technology investments were cut and cut and cut. There was an NRC report specifically on the NIAC. There's been congressional hearings on this subject. For due disclosure, I should point out that I was the co-chair when I was still at Georgia Tech. I was the co-chair of that NRC committee, so I'm very familiar with what the NRC thinks about that program. And we're basically setting up this new NIAC to be in line with the NRC recommendations that are in that report. This will be a program for folks external to NASA to provide some ideas about NASA's future missions. It will also be open to folks inside of NASA for participation. The Center Innovation Fund is also important. What's happened over time is that the NASA centers have less and less money to invest in ideas, to innovate, frankly. Everything has become very structured. Everything has become very program-centered, right? And if you didn't have a charge code, you couldn't get $10K to, you know, to fund some new idea. Is that right, Upendra? Okay, just checking. So what we're doing here is we're going to provide funding to each of the centers. I believe it's going to end up that the center chief technologist, I should point out, there's now a center chief technologist at every center that I'm working with. It's likely that the center innovation funds will be managed by those center chief technologists, and they're going to be encouraged to invest those funds in high-risk, high-payoff kind of efforts. Not everything that they invest in is expected to succeed, but over the broad portfolio, we expect to have a large variety of innovation and idea generation through this fund. And what's also nice about these efforts, these are all early stage efforts, but remember, we have the game-changing program and the cross-cutting program to follow on from some of these early stage ideas will actually have a home now, should they be successful, right? One of the problems about the NIAC previously is that if you did a NIAC phase 1 and a phase 2, then what did you do? or there was no place to take it in NASA beyond the NIAC Phase 2 previously. We now have the game-changing program and the cross-cutting program to feed some of these early-stage ideas into. So let me talk a little bit about game-changing. Game-changing consists of two programs, the game-changing development program and a small SAT technology program. This division will be largely competed as well. Over 70% of the funds will be awarded competitively. And here, as I mentioned, we're focused on maturing the technologies that could lead to entirely new approaches, right? Disruptive technologies that could lead to entirely new approaches for the agency's future missions and solution to significant national needs. Okay. And then finally, in the cross-cutting capability demonstration division, we have three programs. The biggest of them from a dollar value is the technology demonstration missions program. If I had to give you an analogy for that program, I would cite SMD's New Millennium program, frankly. This is, I think, an improved version of the SMD New Millennium program. There will be a small number of missions, but we will actually use that program to take things to low Earth orbit or to whatever the relevant environment is for the technology, improve them at a TRL-6 kind of level. We'll do this program in conjunction with our customers, with the mission directorates, and with other government agencies and things like that. We've also got a small SAT missions program now for the first time. You know that AFRL and other organizations have small SAT mission programs. Ours will be focused on some of the more unique NASA missions, perhaps Earth science, perhaps biological, physical sciences could do some testing through this program. These missions will be selected competitively as well. And then finally, we have the Flight Opportunities Program, which is a new name, but it's actually a merging of two existing programs. The FAST program, which basically flies Vomit Comet kind of flights, and Cruiser, which funds procure services on these reusable commercial vehicles, suborbital commercial vehicles, when they're ready, when they're flying, either for science payloads or for technology experiments. Okay. Now, what's going to come out of this program? To be honest, I can't tell you. All right, I can't. I can't because I told you that it's going to be largely competed. It's going to depend on you. It's going to depend on your ideas. Okay, but I do know that there are a large number of engineering systems that have been looked at over and over again, that have been stuck in concept land, so to speak, that if we could get qualified in a flight-relevant environment, would enable new missions. I know this because I read the decadal surveys, right? I know this because I read all of the human exploration plans. You know, just to cite a couple, aerocapture, right? If we want to do some of the outer planet missions that are cited in the decadal survey, either the past one or the preliminary discussions that are going on with the community right now, aerocapture is a technique to insert a spacecraft, you know, an orbiter, into orbit about a planet with an atmosphere without all the propellant required to do so propulsively, using the atmosphere and the natural drag that's produced to decelerate. Optical communications or high bandwidth communications is something that everyone seems to need, but nobody is really funding. Okay, ESMD claims they need it. SMD claims they need it both for deep space and for Earth science. For you know, because you in Earth science, my understanding is you have so many assets now that we just we're running out of bandwidth is what I've been told. Aeronautics folks are interested in it. Other government agencies are interested in high bandwidth communications. So that's another example of a kind of a big picture advancement. I'll skip the rest. So let me kind of sum up from a high level strategy perspective, and then maybe I could take some questions. A couple things that you don't hear about in the newspaper, okay, that are really important. First of all, NASA got a budget increase, okay? And that's a rare thing. But you know what also is rare is that NASA's whole program is aligned with where the administration wants the entire government to be going. That doesn't always happen either. The Obama administration has shown very clearly that they're interested in research, technology, and innovation. All you need to do is look across the federal government at what was increased and what was not. Okay, you probably know that discretionary spending, you know, the portion of the budget labeled discretionary spending, and I really hate that term, discretionary, but the portion of the budget labeled discretionary spending was held fixed by the Obama administration in their FY11 request. But NASA got an increase. Well, how's that possible? Somebody got a decrease, right? And that happened all throughout the government. Agencies that were doing research and development or were thought to be able to do research and development got increases. Agencies that were more operational in nature and less R&D focused got decreases to pay for those agencies that got an increase. How grateful I am that NASA was on the positive side of that ledger. Okay, I think it's a real honor for NASA not only to get the increase in this economic time, but also to get it in a way where we're aligning NASA with the rest of the federal government. It really helps in building partnerships with the other government agencies, and it also really helps, I think, for NASA to be a part, an integral part, to be seated at the grown-ups table, if you will, with the other research and development agencies in the government. So the NASA budget request is aligned with this national strategy. And in my view, this renewed emphasis on technology in the president's FY11 budget request brings up the research and technology competency, this longstanding core competency, this critical part of NASA that had been down for over a decade. It brings it up and makes it visible again so that it can work hand in hand with the flight systems and the mission operation competencies to make NASA the unique place that it can be, to enable us to do grand challenges in our future flight missions and systems. Now, what's the benefit of this investment in technology? Well, I think it's obvious on the aerospace side of things. I think whether we're talking about aeronautics missions, science missions, or human exploration missions, this investment in research and technology will enable us to take much bigger steps, right? We'll be able to do much grander missions in the future through this investment. But it's also true nationally that this investment will drive our economic competitiveness, will lead to a large number of technology-oriented jobs, will serve as a strong inspiration and motivator for young folks to pursue science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, education and career pathways. And it will also allow us to unleash at least a small portion of NASA's intellectual capital on some pretty significant national needs, right? There are some pretty solid researchers, some very strong researchers, scattered all around the NASA's field centers. You know, they're not in any one place. They're everywhere. And while they're working on their aerospace-specific NASA jobs, they may have an idea that relates to national security or relates to weather and climate or relates to energy. And this strategy that the Obama administration is putting forward would allow a small portion of them to spend some time engaged with the other government agencies in partnerships to take those aerospace applications and apply them to some of these grand problems here on the Earth. And I think that's a big deal too. So there are a number of aerospace reasons. And there are also, in my view, a number of national need kind of reasons why this strategy makes a lot of sense. And I think I'll stop here and see if you have any questions. Thank you.